Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. Given what we've just been talking about, as well as geopolitics and all the rest of it, I feel like there's been, my mom would have said, like there's been a lot of water under the bridge since the last time we explored the topic of religious trauma or religious trauma syndrome together. And this past week, I had a conversation with a young woman who's a part-time cashier at our local gas station, someone who's in her last year of university. And we've sort of had this ongoing conversation, her and I, for a couple of years. Because I came in one night to gas up when she was working, and she had a textbook open on the counter. So she was reading between customers. She was obviously studying, and so I asked her what she was reading, and we just kind of got into it. She was in a philosophy course, and anyway, we had a lovely little conversation about what she was learning about. And so we recognize one another. And so when I came in today, I was like, "How's your studies going? Where are you at?" And she was like, "Well, I'm in my last year. This is my last term at university, and I graduate. And what majors?" And poli sci was one of her majors, so that kind of fairly naturally led to a conversation about geopolitics, in which she said in part something to the effect of, you know, Trump being horrible. And then she kind of had this funny little body thing, because we were looking at one another. We were actually having a conversation. And then she just said it, and then there was like this little, I could sort of see this little thing happen for her where she was like, "Oh, this person is not my peer chronologically. Did I just step on a landmine?" And so I was like, "No worries. Like, I'm with you 100%. And then we just kept going. And I asked her about her future, because she's been really quite open. And so it felt like, you know, we had enough platform for that. And so I just asked, what are you looking forward to? Future dreams, prospects? And what she told me in response to that had two parts. One was she talked about peers of hers who've already graduated who are really struggling to find not just jobs in their field, but just jobs at all. And so that was, you know, she was disheartened by that. And then she said, and I mean, so help me, this just about decked me. And then she said, "And also, I hope the world is still here." And I, to my credit, I did not burst into tears in front of her, but I carried some really big emotions back to the car. I was like, "Oh, ouch," right? Yes. I also said, "I'll share that hope with you. I hope so too, you know?" It's not a small matter when these things that are going on have this kind of impact on us as humans, all ages and stages. And one way to articulate that impact is as the erosion of hope. I think it's kind of a big deal when social institutions, including religious institutions, but not exclusively those, perpetuate teachings or behave in ways that cause harm rather than heal, that denigrate hope, or that kick the can of hope down the road. I can appreciate how it works in terms of it feeling helpful. It's like someday everything's going to be right. That's a powerful idea. And also, it can infantilize the person who believes it. It can disempower the person who believes it, in the sense that we're like, someday everything's going to be fine. I don't have any responsibility now. And that's not proven to be especially helpful. In the meantime, sort of in the midst of all these things, I've also been having some email correspondence with a person who is not familiar with this community, but who's listened to some of the podcasts. And that conversation has reminded me of just how unique what we're on about here really is. This could sound a little bit like pumping our own tires. I'm okay with that. I'll add some nuance as I go. this person made a couple of assumptions that I would say are both understandable, given their context, and not entirely correct. And one we've talked about fairly recently, they assumed that I think of myself as a pastor, which I don't. In fact, I don't think of myself as being involved in leadership of a religious organization at all. I don't serve or lead a community that has a stated creed or dogma. I'm not a fan of the notion of right belief in any absolute sense. I'm not even categorically a supporter of the idea that organized religion is necessarily a good thing. I think it's how we behave what we believe that matters, not what we say we believe. So we can state a good belief as ours, and then if we behave badly, that's how that belief behaves in the world. And also, I'm not trying to get people to believe what I believe, despite the fact that I sometimes say the things that I believe as though they were facts when I hopefully also remember to say that they're ideas. I don't always remember. And, in addition to that, by any religious definition in Christian thought or practice that I'm aware of, as distinct from sort of more general cultural definitions, this isn't a church. Anybody who's ever studied Christian theology will tell you that we do not do the things that any Christian theologian will tell you are the marks of a New Testament church. I'm going to connect this to the healing of religious trauma and RTS in due course, so just stay with me here for a bit. There are lots of ways that we can think about what we might use the language of church for. When I was reflecting on this, what immediately came to mind, because this is often how ideas are sticky for me, was a couple of song lyrics from several years ago. And the first was from a 2017 song by Sheryl Crow called Halfway There, in which she wrestles with how we as people might proceed in the face of diametrically opposed beliefs. And she wrote that particular song in the run-up to Trump's first term in office. Seems to me like it still addresses some rather timely issues. In any case, in that song, she poses a question of what constitutes church this way. Each and every Sunday morning, you sit in your church pew. And by the way, in verse 2, I think the person sitting in the church pew gets there in a Hummer. But anyway, there's lots of stereotypes in here. Each and every Sunday morning, you sit in your church pew. I'm sitting on a mountain taking in this glorious view. Well, I know your God is listening. I know mine must be too. And if God is love and love is godly, why do we argue? Interesting set of questions in there. So her church is sitting on a mountain taking in the view, and that's where she makes her connection to what we might call spirit, or for those of us who grew up around this, we might use God language for that. The other party in this song is in what most of us would recognize as church, both the building and the community. A couple of years before that, 2013, Hozier, who was then a struggling musician, not an international star, like this song barely made it into the world as an artifact, released a song called Take Me to Church. Massive hit. Number one in 12 countries, certified 5 times platinum in the U.S., and he's not from the U.S., nominated for a Grammy for Song of the Year in 2015, clearly resonated with a lot of people, right? Huge hit. And it certainly changed his career trajectory in his life. It's a pretty interesting song. She's the giggle at a funeral, knows everyone's disapproval. I should have worshipped her sooner. If the heavens ever did speak, she's the last true mouthpiece. Every Sunday is getting more bleak, a fresh poison every week. We were born sick, you heard them say it. My church offers no absolutes. She tells me, worship in the bedroom. The only heaven I'll be sent to is when I'm alone with you. I was born sick, but I love it. Command me to be well. Now, then that takes us to the famously hooky chorus, which, I mean, come on. Take me to, like, it just drops into that chorus like a freight train. I mean, it's a great piece of songwriting in terms of popular music. Take me to church, but listen to the lyrics. Take me to church, I'll worship like a dog at the shrine of your lies. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, oh good God, let me give you my life. Now, that lyric is so loaded with erotic imagery that you don't have to be doing deep textual analysis to figure out that this song is about sex. And just in case you want to skip the analysis entirely, you can just look up the interview with Hozier in which he says, quote, take me to church is essentially about sex, close quote. But, and this is where we start to make the connection back to religious trauma, he's also expanded on that core idea about this song this way. Same interview, says this about the song. It's about sex and it's about humanity, and obviously sex and humanity are incredibly tied. Sexuality and sexual orientation, regardless of orientation, is just natural. The song is about, and here's the connection I want to make at this point, the song is about asserting yourself and reclaiming your humanity. And then he goes on to say, through an act of love. So that's the embodied connection that he's making to human sexual behavior connection. And the music video that really broke the song wide open in industry terms was framed as a critique of Russia's anti-LGBTQ+ policies. got more than a few people's backs up, as you can imagine, even just given the point in history when this happened. So 2013, 2015 would have been the video. Now, whether we think that Hozier's take on this is a good idea, a bad idea, or something complicated in between, looking for healing in human connection, however we seek to experience it, and that's one of the ways we seek to experience it, is through our sexuality. Looking for healing in human connection starts to make more sense when we consider what the artist is looking to heal from, right? And he talks about it in verse 1. Every Sunday is getting more bleak, a fresh poison each week. We were born sick, you heard them say it. That's one of the least ambiguous parts of that whole lyric, at least to me. That's pretty direct. And if you've been following along with this series, you might recall that one of the central Christian dogmas that creates such fertile ground for religious trauma is the notion that we arrive in this world irreparably broken with a sinful, rebellious nature about which we can do nothing and from which we need to be saved from the outside. In Hozier's words, we were born sick, you heard them say it. In response to that, within that same song lyric and the attendant interview that I quoted, we get an artist suggesting that the way out of that dilemma is, quote, asserting yourself and reclaiming your humanity. By which he means, among other things, directly disagreeing with the idea that we're sick with a moral disease about which we can do nothing. He just takes that one on head on. This idea of reclaiming our humanity in the face of the sorts of religious trauma that spring from those kinds of teachings is essentially where we left off the last time we were in this series. And throughout the series, we've been working at, and this has sort of been a refrain in the series, we've been working at sharpening our ability to recognize systems that diminish agency, that distort humanity, or that rely on fear. Those have been sort of our working definitions for systems that cause harm. And in the course of that, just by way of a little bit of review, I posed some alternative possibilities, and I posed them as questions, and this is what I said. I said, what happens to many of these toxic systems of belief if we choose to believe that we are capable of guiding our own spiritual life from the inside out? What happens to those toxic systems that say, you can't do that? This has to come from outside of you. What happens if we step away from the idea that it's our permanent condition to always be reaching for some version of salvation that we can never grasp without outside help? What if we entertain the possibility that the resources we need to guide our own spiritual life are already in us, as opposed to always having to come from outside of us? And I went on to suggest that the faculties that we need for a meaningful, ethical, and grounded life, as distinct from the notions of salvation that are grounded in that other framework that I just talked about, might be things like, not an exhaustive list, representative one, things like critical thinking, empathy, conscience, intuition, imagination, and that we don't need to be told who we are or what we must believe. That's a choice. If we receive that kind of teaching, we chose to. Now, having said that, many of us were exposed to those kinds of teaching way before we were acting as self-conscious choosers. This is one of the places in that formative season of our lives. This is one of the places where trauma is most deeply formed for all of those reasons, right? Because we're receiving it with trust. We'll talk about that in a moment. Now, perhaps sadly for some, necessarily for others, maybe even joyfully for still others, stepping away from those harmful ideas may mean stepping away from what has traditionally been identified as church. That's why I spent all that time on what constitutes church a few moments ago. And that is one, it's just one, mind you, it's not the whole story, but that is one of the reasons why the table exists in the particular shape that it does. If it's a traditional church that you're looking for, they are not hard to find. If it's a space where you can approach the possibility of healing from the harms done to you in the context of church, and a place where you can do that kind of work in the company of others, that's a more difficult space to find. Not least of all because the same religious environments that may have caused harm or trauma for some still feel like a safe or safe-ish place to others. And even places or relationships where harm has been done can be enormously hard to leave or even renegotiate our relationship with. We know this in so many contexts in our lives. We've touched on this already in this space, and as our society in general becomes more trauma-informed, many of us have an increasing working knowledge of what trauma is. In the words of a well-known Canadian and internationally known trauma doctor, Gabor Mate, trauma is not what happens to you, it's what happens inside as a result of what happens to you. And he goes on to elaborate with the example of physical trauma. He says this, it's not the blow on the head, it's the concussion I get. Right? An important distinction. Because, again, one person's woohoo is another person's trauma. Right? Like, there's this huge range. It's not the event, it's the impact of the event. And in Mate's personal story, for example, his mother gave him away as an 11-month-old to be raised by a relative because she didn't believe that he could survive the living conditions of a fenced-in Budapest ghetto. And Mate notes that when he tells this story, he notes that the word trauma comes from the Greek word for wound. And when he connects that understanding, that language of trauma equals wound, to his own story, he sees that understanding as good news. And he says it this way, if my trauma was that my mother gave me to a stranger, well, that will never not have happened. It happened. But if the wound was that I decided as a result that I wasn't worthwhile as a human being, I wasn't lovable, that's a wound that can heal at any time. So the blow on the head, the being given away as an infant, I can't undo that. That's history. But the wound that it caused, that I have access to, that can heal. And it's clear that in Mate's understanding of his own story, ill intention was not a prerequisite for trauma or pain. His mother did what she thought was best for him at considerable cost to herself. The result was still trauma. Similarly, in religious settings, the people teaching others what to believe may mean well and still cause harm. We may mean well, perhaps uniquely as parents, or people responsible for the formation of the young. We may mean well and still cause harm. We might still do something that causes a wound. One of my therapist acquaintances, somebody whose kids are similar age to ours, has said for many years in our conversations that their hope is that when their kids are in their late 20s and 30s and they start going to talk to a therapist about all the ways that he messed them up, he's like, I just hope that they can say to the therapist with confidence, I know my dad loves me. It's like if we got that solid, the rest of it, we all make mistakes. We all wound one another. There's going to be work to be done. I hope they can be solid about that. That's his baseline. I've always found that instructive and hopeful as a parent, among other things. Basil van der Kolk. Van der Kolk is one of the seminal thinkers and practitioners in the realm of trauma, and particularly like a sort of the godfather of PTSD. This is the guy who was doing the work on the ground with American military veterans in particular that sort of named PTSD, brought it into the world by that name. He states that in order for us to heal, we must have an understanding of the source of the wound. Got to peel the onion far enough to get to where did this wound come from. And one of the things that makes healing from trauma, including religious trauma and its attendant syndromes, religious trauma syndrome, that whole bundle, one of the things that makes healing from trauma potentially complex is that the same part of the brain that is responsible for helping the body complete the trauma cycle and expel the energy from responding to whatever the event is, the get stuck part, that's the same part of the brain that develops verbal language. And it's also the part of the brain where activity is suppressed during a traumatic or overwhelming experience to protect the person who's on the receiving end of that experience, right? And in the case of PTSD, this is also the space in our brain where religious trauma often resides and where it stays suppressed. And one of the reasons for that is that developing language is crucial to healing, not just so we can speak about what happened, but also so we can express the sensations and emotions that are going on in our bodies, where the trauma is stored. One of the common markers of a traumatized person is that when you ask how they feel or how an emotion feels within their body, they tell you instead what they think or what they cognitively know about that emotion. They don't have language for how it actually feels, or they can't access language for how that emotion feels. There's a disconnect. And healing is, when it comes to trauma, in many ways about reconnecting that disconnect. We might say that a very important aspect of healing is being able to connect with the deep inner wisdom necessary for the development of resilience and one's own autonomous identity. It's what Hozier is talking about when he says we need to assert ourselves and reclaim our humanity. As is often the case, at least for me, and I've talked to enough people about this that I know it's not just me. In order to get started on something big, and make no mistake, what we're talking about here is something big, we need to break it down into smaller pieces and then even smaller pieces until we find the space where we can take action on something. And a little bit like that little exercise bumper sticker trope, you know, everything counts. This is kind of in that space, right? It's like the key is get started. Doesn't have to be grandiose. Doesn't have to be the testimonial that says, I'm healed. Don't even think like that. It just stops us before we start. This is about breaking it down far enough that we're like, what's a step that I can take? And then not judging ourselves immediately as though that step was insufficient or inadequate or too small. It's about getting started. And I'm going to suggest that one way to think about that process when it comes to healing from, or as someone recently suggested to me, healing with religious trauma or RTS can be approached in a bunch of different ways. In order to get the journey of healing from religious trauma or RTS underway, we might need the following, or we might need things that touch on these kinds of areas in our lives. We might need to release ourselves from a harmful environment. We might be somewhere where the harm is ongoing, still being caused. The teachings that made the space for the harm are still being perpetuated or still being offered as the truth to us. We might need to find a way to step away from that environment itself. We need to establish a sense of safety.
Yes.
Or at least safer.
That's right.
I don't think safety, not safety, is a binary. That's
right.
Not a light switch.
Yeah.
Right? It's too complicated for that. But we certainly need to move in that direction. And we need to give ourselves permission to believe a different story about ourselves, a different story about the world, and a different story about whatever we are using God language for. None of those are little maneuvers, right? None of those are not small ideas, any of them. And so again, trying to find a way to go, well, if for example, I need to release myself from a harmful environment, does the first step mean like closing the door on that environment and being on the other side of a door? Does it mean taking a slightly different path? Does it mean taking a step in a slightly different direction in some way? I remember somebody pointing out to me when it comes to life change many years ago that if you imagine your journey through life in a sort of a literal, I'm traveling kind of a metaphor, right? Literal metaphor, pick one, Tim. As an I'm traveling metaphor, and you're thinking about it as having a compass bearing. I'm going to go 3 degrees north of due north. That's my path. And then you're like, well, I'm going to go 4 degrees east of north instead of 3. 1 degree. And you put that on a map, it looks like this over time. Right? Like those points get further and further apart as you travel. And that's been a really important and reanimating metaphor for me over time. 1 degree. Right? It's not magic. It's not flipping a switch. It's a little change. And then time. We're going to dig into all of those three more and others as we go forward, but for the balance of our time today, I want to connect what I've already said about this collective not being a church to the first of those ideas, releasing ourselves from this harmful environment, from a harmful environment. And I want to be careful with these ideas because I think that it would be too easy to lurch into this kind of, at the table, we aren't prone to those same things that might have produced the religious trauma for someone in the first place. And we are vulnerable to those same things. It would be incredibly naive to think that we're not. Every collective is. Every group, every company, every family, every collective. You got a society, it's vulnerable to these things. Remember, ill intent is not a prerequisite for causing harm. We don't have to be part of a bad collective, categorically, to be in a place where harm can be caused. We can be part of a loving family, and harm can be caused. We can be part of a caring community, and harm can be caused. It's not about ill intent. And of course, there are occasions where there is ill intent as well. So we're just as vulnerable to that as a collective as anybody else. Having said that, the existence of the table in the shape that it now takes, with this clearly defined why of making room to explore what we believe, that's an attempt to provide a space in which we can, together, release ourselves from what was, for many of us, a harmful environment. We can step away from it, even if it's just a degree. There are many reasons why this collective doesn't have what many churches do, like a statement of beliefs or a statement of dogma. We believe, and then a something on the web page that lists these 12 things. One of the reasons why we don't have that is this structural choice to attempt to make and maintain a space where there is no religiously sanctioned boilerplate. There's nothing that says these are the right beliefs that will save you. Are there downsides to that choice? Absolutely there are. Among them, the downside of not having the potentially reassuring, self-securing backstop of the beliefs held by me and mine are the big T truth. Like, that's an incredibly reassuring thing to be able to believe, if you can believe it. And most of us have the capacity to believe it in some shape or other. A space without that sort of structure might feel liberating for one person and like being in free fall to someone else. It's not magic. It's a choice. So this isn't for everyone. But if you're considering the possibility that part of your lived experience might be religious trauma or syndromes that are adjacent to that or arise from it, then a space where you can step away from the environment that structurally, in terms of the beliefs it was perpetuating, that caused that harm, is an essential early step. It's also one of the reasons why it's not that unusual for somebody to be part of the table community for a season and then to move on. Right? This supported that step. I don't have to hold on to the edge of the coffee table anymore. I can walk on my own, if you want an actual literal learning how to walk kind of illustration from toddlerhood, right? And I don't mean that in any demeaning or diminishing way. I think watching children learn how to walk is one of the most astonishing things in the world. You could call a space like I'm trying to describe. I don't know how well it feels like I'm doing, but you could call a space like that room to explore what you believe. That's what we decided to call it. It's why we're here, and it's what we're trying to make, and it's what we're trying to offer to others. So, until the next time we gather, I just want to encourage us to keep on exploring what we believe and to remember, and this is sort of part B for us in terms of how, the how of our why, remember that you don't have to do it alone. There are other people that are doing this too. Some of them are here. We can do it together. Peace.